everyone, and welcome to episode 125 of the Medieval Podcast. I'm Danielle Cebulski, also known as the 5-Minute Medievalist. One of the things that's unfortunately true about people in the Middle Ages, and people in general if we're being honest, is a mistrust of difference, especially when it comes to religion. In medieval Europe, Christians, Jews, and Muslims shared space, which meant that these communities noticed the differences between them and often tried to separate themselves from each other. But what caused a lot of anxiety, mistrust, and tension, especially for medieval Christians, wasn't always the differences between themselves and their neighbors. It was the similarities. This week, I spoke with Dr. Adrian Williams Boyarin about the tension of sameness in 13th century England. Adrian is an associate professor of English at the University of Victoria in British Columbia and the editor and translator of The Siege of Jerusalem and Miracles of the Virgin Mary for Broadview Press. She's also the author of Miracles of the Virgin in Medieval England, Law and Jewishness in Marian Legends, and the brand new book, The Christian Jew and the Unmarked Jewess, The Polemics of Sameness in Medieval English Anti-Judaism. Here's our conversation on Jewish life in 13th century England, how women's lives especially were entwined across religious borders, and how medieval Christians perceived the similarities between themselves and their Jewish neighbors. Thanks, Adrian, for coming and talking to us about Jewish life in England in the 13th century, especially. Mm-hmm. Now, your book is about sameness, so we're going to get into that in a second. Yeah. But yeah. I was just asking you, we've had some technical difficulties, asking you about what we can know about Jewish life at this time and in this place.
And I was just telling you before the technical difficulties. There's not a lot that we can know from the Jewish perspective in England. But, you know, we do know that there were Jewish communities in England from shortly after the Norman conquest. We know that the community was mostly in urban centers throughout the country. We know that it was very litigious. And by that, I mean both that there was a kind of necessitated litigious existence because the English state created one in order to keep control over the Jewish population, and also because of the sort of legal relationship between Jews and the king's bench, right? Also, Jewish law itself was very litigious. So these things sort of meet in our records. I mean, key to my book is that we know that both men and women were very active in lending businesses and in exchequer proceedings. We know that the apparatus of the exchequer for the Jews kept track of not only money issues and lending, but also civil cases, criminal cases. We know that Jewish and Christian people worked together in running the big litigious apparatus, but also in the realms of childcare. And, you know, I talk a little bit in my book about Jews and Christians keeping expensive items at each other's homes during times of trouble, and Christians storing, you know, the chests and belongings of their Jewish neighbors during, for instance, the Second Barons' War. But I mean, a lot of what I get into in the book is the fact that in England, the records are very odd, because even though they're so abundant, there's very little we have that isn't filtered by the state apparatus, right? And I'm using state on purpose, by the way, by sort of anachronistic by it, but by analogy to modern oppressive states and systems and structures of violence and racism and all of that, that Geraldine Hang in particular really gets into in her invention of race in the European Middle Ages.
So you're mentioning that a lot of the documentation we have is due to litigation. And I think it's important to point out that that's mostly in the king's court, like you were saying, the king's bench, because the Jews are under the jurisdiction of the king at this time, right? They're supposed to be afforded the special protection of the king at this time,
right.
Aren't they?
That's right. They're actually called the king's Jews, right?
Yes.
The idea is that they're under the king's protection, and therefore, you know, even down to the local level, they're under the sheriff's protection and the castle warden's protection. And it's an economic arrangement, right? They become the kind of national kind of credit apparatus, mostly Jewish, not solely Jewish, for the king. And so part of what's at stake is that land and debts and inheritance and all of that, portions of it or all of it, depending on circumstances, go back to the king in the case of deaths or imprisonment or other kinds of forfeitures. So, you know, it's actually a very important relationship. It's kind of underpinning a lot of, or a good chunk of, the national economy.
Yeah, and this is especially difficult in the 13th century because the kings are not being all that kind or respectful of their relationship. So your book is talking about sameness. So I think it's probably important to talk about some of the ways in which difference was meant to be pointed out and the reasons why people wanted to show a difference between Christians and Jews at this time.
Yeah, I mean, and part of what I'm getting into is that I want people to consider difference and sameness together. And I want people to think of processes of othering along with processes of saming. And I'm not quite arguing that these things are two sides of the same coin. I think they're actually quite distinct, but they do work together. If we think about Jewish difference and the kind of Jewish difference that's ascribed to Jews by Christians in 13th century England, we're beginning in that period to see visual representations that are grotesque and violent, particularly around biblical scenes, but also in doodles in the margins of, you know, exchequer roll documents and things like that, where you're starting to see, you know, the large noses, the badge of the identification badges, which in England took the form of the mosaic tablets. So I like to say in practice, they look like an open book, right? Yeah. So we start to see that kind of visual register, but it's pretty much solely around men. And part of what I was kind of noticing is that if you got into discussions of difference in, say, Anthony Bale's work or Miriam Nkrumah or even some of Miri Rubin's work, you know, Sarah Lipton's work, if you start to kind of investigate difference there, that it was really almost solely about the male Jew. Sarah Lipton is really the one who starts looking for women and but has trouble with it, right, in the visual register. But why are, you know, reasons that you would need to establish difference, or you would want to communicate stark difference or contrast, have to do, of course, with differentiating between, you know, the saved and the unsaved in a theological perspective, justifying oppression by dehumanizing, you know, mechanisms that we're familiar with in different contexts now, and unfortunately still in terms of anti-Semitism
and anti-Judaism.
All right, so we're talking about how it's especially important to the Christians at the time to establish a difference between Christians and Jews. And that is because it's very difficult to tell, looking at a human being, what their religion is and often what their ethnicity is.
I didn't even mention that part. Thank you for leading me to the obvious. Yeah. Right. I mean, why would you need distinctive clothing or badges of identification or rules about who mixes with whom in the realms of medicine or food or life cycle events if you weren't having a problem with mixing and distinguishing people from each other? And I think I open the book with the kind of quick consideration of the Fourth Lateran Council canons that require distinction by clothing and identification badges between Christians, Jews, and Muslims, because there the anxiety is really about miscegenation and who dresses like whom, when, or like what, when, and, you know, the possibility of procreation and all of these things. So those are the kinds of laws, yeah, that you don't expect unless there's an existing issue, right?
Yep, exactly.
An existing mixing that happens, or an existing problem of distinguishing people from each other.
Yeah. And you started the book talking about male difference, because when it comes to human bodies, there's only the one male difference that you can tell between Christians and Jews. And so, at least in the medieval mind. And so when you have
Are
a couple
you talking
of examples.
About circumcision,
I am. I'm leading there because some of the examples that you have in the book talk about how people had to be examined and they had to be displayed naked so that they could be shown the difference. We can tell the difference between them, but only if we display them in their full glory.
Right. And of course, one of the key examples that I use early in the book is a case where even that sort of repetitive examination causes problems. So the thing that even when you have the thing I'll call it a thing. Even when you have the thing that is supposed to obviously tell you difference, yeah, right? Then, you know, you can have situations where even that becomes a problem. Is circumcision representative of the Christ-like, you know, the Christ child, or is it Jewishness? So depending on who's doing the reading of it, it turns out to be a problem, actually.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's an important point that you're getting to, where the Christians didn't necessarily view all people who are Jewish as being Christ killers in the anti-Semitic terms of the time, but also thought of them as being potential Christians, right? These are people that can be saved. So can you talk a little bit about how that perspective really influenced how Christians treated Jews or saw Jews at this time?
Yeah, and this is really mostly my argument. trying to filter like influence from where I've come out with my own thinking on this. You know, I was very interested in contemporary Jews, right? So living Jews in England and how these kinds of debates that are kind of the purview of Christian theology and polemic, how we could imagine those affecting Jews. Mm-hmm. And how we could imagine Jews responding to them. And so, you know, I really wanted to get at this kind of idea that there is some evidence of mutual influence that we can get at if you put together evidence from enough different sources, right?
Yeah.
Particularly the literary and the devotional and the visual and with the historical records. So I've locate this idea both in the kind of logic of supersession, which, you know, I especially lean on Kathleen Biddick and the idea that to be the good Christian, you are always potentially doubled with the Jew. Mm-hmm. And this is a logic of supersession. But then I'm building on that to get to the contemporary 13th century English Jews. And one of the people I lean on is Orme, of all people, the author of the Ormulum homily collection, who takes New Testament sort of good Jews, like the disciple Nathaniel, mm-hmm. and praises them for their Jewishness, for being truly Jewish, which to him is exactly the same as being truly Christian, right? It leans on this logic. It's a kind of historical logic now, or chronological logic, where if you go into Christ's time and his ministry, you have a Jewish setting. Mm-hmm. And the Christians are simply the Jews who made the right choice, right? So there were two paths to take, and the Christians are the Jews that were right, right? So,
yeah.
So this is Orme's logic, and he constructs it through looking at New Testament figures who made the right choice, right? Mm-hmm. And then he extends the analogy to the present day by imagining that both his congregation, his Christian congregation, and I, you know, my inference is that you can turn that around to think about Jews near where Orme was writing, that there's still the potential. You could be a bad Christian and therefore be a Jew, and you could be a good Christian and therefore be a good Jew, right? Like, so, and he's really maintaining all that. So one of the reasons I start with these like two longest chapters that are so much focused on Orme is not because Orme was popular. He wasn't, right? We, you know, there's not multiple copies or evidence that his homilies spread through England or anything, but the fact that, you know, he fleshes out this kind of rhetoric of doubling and potential in a way that's really useful, and for me allowed me to start to see it in other places, to know that it wasn't just him. And so the idea that you might convert the Jews might become Christians. Of course, that's always there. Mm-hmm. You know, that's the whole teleology, right? Like, that's what we want to get to from the medieval Christian perspective. Mm-hmm. And honestly, from some modern Christian perspectives. Mm-hmm. and so that potential is always there. And then underneath it is the kind of strange potential for Christians to kind of move back and forth between Christianness and Jewishness.
Yeah, absolutely. And these things are, they're simultaneous. And you really kind of have to dig into the theology to see how it works in a lot of cases.
Right. I you know, have felt all along. And when I was writing the book, that the first kind of third to half of it seemed in some ways beside the point, because what I really wanted to get to was the contemporary and women.
Yes.
But it was so fundamental to the larger arguments to establish that this was a way of thinking, that the kinds of polemics I talk about, the polemics that are aimed explicitly at making Jews and Christians the same.
Yes, and there's so much of that. But let's get into the contemporary and women, because I think this is when it hits its stride, definitely. Yeah. And I think there's a lot to say about that. Okay, so women especially were moving between Christian and Jewish communities more than anyone else. So can you tell us some of the ways they did that?
Yeah, well, you know, since we don't have tons of records from England, or at least not in the same way that we do from the continent, I really lean on Elisheva Baumgarten here in sort of drawing kind of likely similarities. So her work has really proven that Jewish and Christian women in Ashkenaz were meeting in midwifery, medical environments, wet nursing, childcare, in all these day-to-day ways that don't often make it into the records. But they do a little bit in England, where there's plentiful evidence for Christian wet nurses in Jewish homes. And you do see kind of worrying about this at various policy levels, both ecclesiastical and non-ecclesiastical policies. You see heightened anxiety around distinguishing Jewish and Christian women from each other. So I even cite this sort of instance where Edward I kind of reissues a comment about his badge of identification law, saying, like, seriously, women, though, women, like, yeah, I said women, I mean women, you know, so there's this, there seems to be heightened anxiety around indistinguishability when it comes to women. But I think those domestic environments are so important and so easy to ignore, because they're not what tends to be recorded, right? Mm-hmm. But we also have lists, and you know, Hannah Meyer has written an amazing dissertation on wet nursing between Jewish and Christian women in England. So I just want to acknowledge her, because if it weren't for her, actually, honestly, if it weren't for her dissertation, I'm not sure that she stayed in academia, but if it weren't for her dissertation, I would not have known where to start looking for some of this stuff. We see there that Christian women in droves are being excommunicated for being household servants or wet nurses for Jewish families throughout England. And I'm not sure that they cared. There is, seriously, I mean, this is another thing that has itched at me about some of the scholarship on these kinds of interactions, is that there's an assumption that if rules are put out, like, you can't be a wet nurse, you can't be a servant in a Jewish home, or, you know, you can't come out on Easter or Good Friday, or you can't, you know, these kinds of rules for Christians and Jews, there's this assumption that, you know, well, then I guess that was that. I mean, how often do we, levels of devoutness aside, how often do we go with whatever policy, you know, is that not all Catholics are walking around obeying Catholic dogma or decree, right? So we don't have to imagine that such policies are actually effective, or that people actually care about them. I can well imagine Christian women working in Jewish homes who could give a shit, you know? Am I allowed to say that?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, as long as we don't drop a whole bunch of them, you're good.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's hard to care about your immortal soul when you're trying to put food on the table. I mean, these wet nurses, they're not the highest echelons of society. They need to eat.
This is probably true. Yeah. If we get to the levels of society where basic survival and eating and all of that becomes part of it, then it's easy to imagine lots of things outside the realm of what's recorded history.
Yeah.
There's also lots of records of women, Christian and Jewish women, trading, loaning money, both to each other and to men, working together in marketplaces. And, you know, that's a lot of the evidence I go through in my initial chapter on Jewish women in the book.
Yeah, one of the coolest tiny stories that you have in the book is where Christians are actually being taken to court by a Jewish family because they were asked to hold on to a chest full of items, while there was unrest, and then they were asked to give it back. And the husband, the Jewish husband, says, "I saw the Christian wife with this belt buckle," and the Christian wife says, "Actually, actually, this was a discussion that we had, the two wives together, about what was correct payment for something else." So those backroom discussions, it's so cool when you get a glimpse of those.
That's right. Yeah. The two wives were dealing without the husband's knowledge. And then that becomes record, right? So no, that's a very cool, like, small story of the types of things that go on, right? And it seems really normal. This is what we were saying before we started recording, you know, that it's very important to me that we look at the Jewish community in England, not just in a lachrymose way, not just as a series of tragedies, but also as many, many generations, 200 years of Jewish life in England that surely also had babies and childcare and poetry and ritual and weddings and neighbors. And, you know, so it's important to me that when we dig down on this stuff, including on the anti-Jewish context, that we're thinking that way, in addition to considering the tragedies and the oppression that's obviously there and that ends, well, that comes to a heightened point with the expulsion. Yeah.
Yes. I do want to get to the expulsion in just a second, but I think that story really highlights what you're talking about, these interpersonal relationships, because how close would you have to be with your neighbors to say, "Can you hold my valuables?"
Yeah.
While there's unrest going on, there has to be a relationship there. So I'm glad in there.
And the idea that the Jewish diaspora in England was, I mean, it was interrupted, right? Mm-hmm. It could have been something else. This wasn't inevitable. That sort of fuels me when keeping that in mind. There was something really real lost, and it wasn't, well, the loss was largely because of anti-Judaism, but that's not what the loss is about, if you see what I mean.
Yeah.
Much more underneath. Yeah.
Yeah, so much underneath. I do want to talk about the expulsion, and not in a way that's melodramatic as we're talking about. Okay. So Edward I expelled the Jews, but in addition to the ones that left, there were people that converted as well. And some of the things that you talk about in the book are that we're talking about sameness, right? So a Jewish person has done everything possible to fit into society, including conversion, and they're still seen with suspicion afterwards. So can you talk about what life was like for people who were converts, especially after the expulsion? Because you do get into that a bit in the book.
I do, especially around women's status. And I think, you know, this was this idea I had that the converts tend to kind of slip through scholarly treatments of Jews in England, and I mean Jews on the continent as well, because in a way they're rejected by both parties, right? They're from a Jewish perspective, they've become Christian and they're not to be remembered in a way. And from a Christian perspective, they're always Jews no matter what. I mean, the obvious example of how that works structurally is the House of Converts in London that Henry III set up and Edward I maintained, and that continued after the expulsion, where, yes, you've converted to Christianity and now you are segregated in the House of Converts, marked as the place where Jews who converted go, right? You know, that's just one example. But I was interested in thinking of particularly the women who converted as Jews. That is, these were Jewish women for a lot of their lives. They were Jews who made a decision, and their Jewishness certainly affects them as they live the rest of their lives as Christians. And it certainly affects how people see them, what's recorded about them. So I'm sort of doing the experiment of thinking of converts from Judaism as Jewish, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you get a lot more out of kind of mining the relationships and dynamics between Jewish and Christian people in the 13th century by doing that, in the 13th century and beyond.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think for women, it was very, you know, there was a lot of questions. There's evidence of a lot of questions from both Jewish and Christian sides about how legitimate a conversion is, when exactly it happened, whether it ever happened, how valid is it? Then what does it mean for this family or that property? Or, you know, how does it affect the Jewish family that the person came from? We have this extraordinary case of this woman called Alice of Worcester, who converted and was sent to into monastic care, because converts were also sent to different monasteries around England to be cared for and live there, where she finds herself in this position of kind of wandering all over the country and is eventually probably in the House of Converts, but it's hard to track her. We know she goes from Worcester to Chester and Coventry, and she's asking for help for her and her son who has converted with her. And she's having a lot of trouble. She's destitute. And she's having trouble finding places that will take her in and care for her. And she appeals and writes letters to and sends her son as a courier to the king, right? Both in Gascony and in England. This is early in Edward's reign. And then we have converts who stayed after the expulsion, as you were mentioning, who were both in the House of Converts and not, and moving around England and, you know, asking for care again, asking for re-entry into the House of Converts. There's evidence of women, you know, into the 1400s being considered Jews, even though they're converts. So there's the women from Joan of Dartmouth and her daughter, where, you know, they're referred to by the king as Jews who entered the country and then decided to let Christianity go and sort of take care of our Jews, right? So there's a really difficult line. And I mean, I have a lot of compassion for women in this position and men as well. We can't quite understand what the kind of stark reality was in the wake of the expulsion, especially. You know, it's just human to imagine scenarios in which conversion seemed to be a viable choice for survival.
Even knowing that you'd have to leave your community behind.
Yeah. When you did that. Well, and it's also possible, of course, to imagine that there were sincere conversions. I'm not, you know.
Of course, of course.
All of them were. There certainly were sincere conversions from Christianity to Judaism. Mm-hmm. You know, I talk about a couple of those cases in the book as well. Usually they involve women. That's why they become interesting. That's one reason they become interesting to me.
Yeah, one is a Dominican friar, I think, right?
That's right. Yeah.
I think that's a great story. Again, like a really human story. I think there was one in the news not too long ago about a Spanish bishop that also let go of his vocation for love. So nice to see this
good
human
for them. Yeah. No.
Well, it's kind of ironic that, you know, the converts don't get the benefit of the doubt, even despite the fact that their conversion was the whole goal
yes.
of the Christian effort. And even when they get there, they're still mistrusted, which is...
Yeah, that in particular is not a medieval problem.
No.
But it's a problem. I shouldn't get too polemical myself.
Yes. But. Okay. So we're talking about intersections of women and priests and friars. And I think this is an important part of the book that maybe we don't hear too often outside of your book. And that is that the Jewish women at this time were super literate. And one of the places that they did meet with the Christian community was in books and dealing with the clergy. So can you talk about that for a sec?
Yes. I mean, well, there's evidence in the historical record from all over England that women who were in lending businesses were lending to religious communities and scholarly communities. But the evidence for the books comes especially from Oxford, which makes sense, where we see that women are maintaining and keeping libraries of books that they're holding sort of as collateral for loans, and then sometimes selling. We see cases where women brought books to the House of Converts when they converted, and they're all Christian Latin books. And, you know, this doesn't have to mean that Jewish women read Latin at a level that would allow them to read the kinds of books they were keeping. But, you know, there are degrees of literacy. And I think women in lending certainly would have had to understand some legal Latin and legal French, and the ability to hold and maintain and navigate books and all of that is a kind of literacy. It's a kind of bookishness, right? Mm-hmm. So it's an important piece of the evidence for the types of literacy that Jewish women had. I'm planning on writing about this elsewhere, but it's my conviction that Jewish women in England were and had to be very multilingual. And of course, there can be bits and pieces of languages. There can be variations in literacy in different languages, but you don't imagine generations, 200 years of people living as neighbors without you know, we imagine that Jews in England settled as French speakers, but also that, you know, you don't stay for those generations without also speaking English. You don't work in these fields, and this is Judith Schlanger really gets into this now. You don't work in the businesses that Jewish women work in without having some facility with Hebrew and some facility with Latin. And it's easy to imagine also in border areas, some facility with Welsh, for instance. So I really think that we have to look at women this way, and the fact of their domestic context actually heightens that, I think. And there's a lot of scholarship that imagines that Jews in England did not speak English. And it's just impossible in my view, after the first generation. And that's a really interesting aspect of who they were. And I will write something more detailed about that pretty soon. So,
well, I'm glad. And I think that's a huge part of the book and the whole thesis behind your work being that you can have people who are interacting in these communities, they can look the same, they can pass for each other because they're intermeshed. These communities are brought together and intermeshed. And so when we look at history as being sort of these clean cuts where, you know, you have two separate societies in the same town and then one gets expelled and then there's no more after that, like, I think it's doing history a disservice and the people who are living it a disservice if we just see it as these distinct categories.
Not to mention, of course, after the expulsion, that Jewish merchants were, you know, Jews could come and go in England without settling there. So the idea that there's no more experience of Jewish presence after the expulsion is flawed. Anyway, you
know. That's a polite way of putting it.
Yeah, but I mean, you're right. That's why this historical undergirding, I don't know, that sounds like a weird word, but for what I'm trying to describe, but that's why it's so important to me to fill in these spaces, because it really does help us imagine how something like polemical sameness used by Christians for anti-Jewish rhetoric, it really helps us see how something like that can develop. Mm-hmm. Why it would develop, how it would be useful, how it would, you know, be familiar and plausible, and therefore how it could be effective. And as I say a few times in the book, very insidiously effective.
Yeah.
We have to look for it, and it's hard to see.
Well, I'm awfully glad that you looked for it. It's a great book. Yeah. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast to tell us all about it. Thanks, Adrian.
Thank you for having me, Danielle.
To find out more about Adrian's work, you can visit her University of Victoria faculty page, which, as it turns out, has a really long URL, so I'll put it in the show notes on medievalist.net. But here's a shortened version from bit.ly, which is bit.ly/2xe5vmt. Her new book is The Christian Jew and the Unmarked Jewess, The Polemics of Sameness in Medieval English Anti-Judaism. Before we go, here's Peter from medievalist.net to tell us what's on the website. What's new this week, Peter?
Hey. This week, we have some ancient history on the website. I know, it's not medieval, but it's mostly medieval. The good people, the Power of Medieval Text series, they did a comparison on like book production and circulation, and they look at like ancient Rome, late antiquity, and Carolingian times. So we allow them to put a little ancient history.
I like ancient history. It's still good history.
It's not medieval. It's okay. So we have that. We also look at Masons in medieval London and why they came together in fraternities and guilds. And we got some news on a 13th century mass grave.
Ooh, that sounds really interesting.
Always is. Find out how people got massively killed.
Okay, will do. Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.
Thank you, as always, to our patrons on patreon.com for all your support. Patrons of the Medieval Podcast can choose from all sorts of amazing stuff, like subscriptions to Medieval Warfare Magazine and the Medieval Magazine, membership in our book club, and our exclusive maps by Tina Ross. To find out how to become a patron of the Medieval Podcast, please visit patreon.com/medievalists. For everything from religion to relationships, follow medievalist.net on Facebook or Twitter @medievalists. You can find me, Danielle Cebulski, on social media @5minmedievalist or 5 Minute Medievalist. And you can find all my books at your favorite online bookstores, where you can also pre-order the new one, How to Live Like a Monk, Medieval Wisdom for Modern Life, which comes out next month. Our music is Beyond the Warriors by Guy Frog. Thanks for listening, and have yourself an awesome day.